Okay. Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, good night to all our listeners. My name is Tom Raftery and I'm speaking today with Robert Scobel. Robert is a technical evangelist. In fact, Robert is the technical evangelist from Microsoft. He's Microsoft's most visible blogger and he's one of technology's most influential bloggers. Robert is coming to Cork in Ireland on the 30th of November this year to speak at IT at Cork's annual conference. Robert, first of all, thanks a million for agreeing to do this podcast for me and for accepting our invitation to speak at the conference.
Hey, thank you very much for having me on.
That's great. Robert, I'm just going to give a quick explanation for people who might be listening now who know nothing about IT at Cork. IT at Cork is a not-for-profit networking organization for IT professionals. Our 200-plus member companies come from a diverse range of backgrounds. We have everything from banks, telcos, pharmaceutical companies, right the way through to small one- or two-person companies. The chairman of IT at Cork is Donal Manning, and Donal is the IT manager of Heineken Ireland, for example. So it's not IT companies per se, it's any companies who have an interest in IT or an IT division or anything like that. In IT Cork, we run events for our membership at least once a month. We've had 15 events so far this year. They're free for our members, and they're on topics as diverse as J2EE, RSS, and we've sales and, you know, soft skills ones like selling to multinationals and things like that. So, that's the plug for IT at Cork. And the conference is, as I said, on the 30th of November. Robert, you're giving two addresses at our conference. You're giving the opening talk on business blogging, and you're giving a second talk in the technical forum on the next 5 years of social software. If I talk for a second about the first, or if I ask you, I should say, about the first talk you're going to be giving on business blogging. In Ireland, we have still very few Irish companies who are blogging. Can you give reasons why you would advise a company to have a blog?
There's one word, and it's called Google.
Right.
And here's what I mean by that. I was at the, and it's not just Google, right? I'm being a little facetious there. It's all the search engines that bring traffic to your site.
Sure.
But I went to, I was just 2 weeks ago, I was at Monster Cable, which is a fairly large company, and they said, you know, we asked you to come over because we have a problem. When we go to Google or MSN or Yahoo and we type in the word home theater, you don't find us, and we believe we're the home theater experts. We have people who've been doing home theaters for 30 years working here, and we make the cables for home theaters, and you can't find us even if you look through the first, you know, 200 results on Google.
Ouch.
And what we did notice was all these blogs keep showing up, and they were wondering, you know, why that is and how to change that. And the reason for that is the more inbound links, or the more people who link to your site, the higher on the Google PageRank system you go. And MSN and Yahoo use similar algorithms to decide the ranking of when you type a word into a search engine, what do you see? And then we have a discussion about, well, how do you get people to link to you? Is it by having a static corporate site that was popular in the late 1990s? Is that going to get enough people to link to you? Or is it going to be some site that changes often? And the site that changes often is going to be more likely to get linked to because there's new content there. There's no new information. And then I said, you know, what's more interesting for most people to link to or talk about or comment on? Is it going to be a corporate site that's done by a committee and everything is safe and you only talk about yourself? Or is it a blogger who builds an authority in the world and starts talking about what he knows or she knows, or talks about the people in the industry, or talks about the industry as a whole instead of just the company that they work for? And of course they say, oh yeah, lots of people would link to you know, a blogger like that, not to a corporate site, you know. And that's usually when the light comes on and says, okay, something has changed in the world and we need to play a different game if we want to be part of this world, part of this online world.
Sure.
You know, and that leads to blogging, or it leads to buying ads. and ads are one way, but ads won't get you the most passionate users. You know, the most passionate users rarely click on ads. They usually take the thing that comes up in the Google or MSN or Yahoo engines much more authoritatively than the advertising on that page.
Sure. It's also, I would imagine, a bit to do with the fact that the people who do blog, who become the authority in a particular area, usually have comments turned on their posts, and you thereby get the chance to converse with people you'd never get access to normally.
Yep, and that's the next stage, right? The first stage is just realizing that they're being out-executed on a website by their competitors.
Yeah.
The second stage is, oh, wait a second, there's millions of people around the world who are, and I can search for people who have written about home theater, or search for people who have written about software, or search for people who have written the word Linux on their blog. You mean I can find everybody in the world who wrote the word Linux in the past, you know, half an hour? And then they realize, wow, there's something going on here that's beyond just how do you participate in the web, you know? A good example of that is I was talking to the European Football Association, you know, and I right before my talk, when I went and talked to them, I wrote a little post saying, hey, I'm going to be talking to the EUFA today and in a few minutes. And by the end of the talk, they had already shown up in Feedster for the word EUFA. So that post had already shown up. And that showed that they could watch what everybody in the world was saying about EUFA by just going to one search engine.
So you wrote a post before the talk, and before the talk was over, a search in Google brought up the post that you wrote.
It wasn't Google. Google takes a day or two to show posts up. There was a blog search engine called Feedster.
Right. Yeah.
And Technorati does the same thing. And there's Ice Rocket does the same thing. There's a bunch of different blog search engines that I can watch what anybody says on their blog. And it shows, you know, so if you write, you know, I'm into bowling, on your blog, I can do a search for the word bowling, and you'll show up in Feedster for the word bowling within half an hour, an hour.
Right. So for companies who are interested in this technology, it's a form of gathering market intelligence.
Absolutely.
So if they're interested in avian flu, they have a search for avian flu, and they find anyone who's written anything about avian flu in the last 2-3 days, week, whatever.
Absolutely, and this is why there's a lot of PR power to blogging, because the journalists are doing exactly this. They're going to the search engines and searching on the things that they are assigned to write about.
Uh-huh.
And so they get the story. If they're the ones watching the blog search engines, they get the stories before anybody else. I was watching the word tsunami when last winter tsunami hit, and within a week there was thousands of posts, and you could see posts go from blogs to the front page of the New York Times in less than 48 hours. It was really remarkable.
Wow, powerful stuff. You've written a book recently called Naked Conversations with Shel Israel, and in that book you came up with you've used a term, brand evangelists.
Yeah.
What are brand evangelists?
Well, I'm a technical evangelist here and at Microsoft, and that's not a new term. That term started at Apple Computer.
Guy Kawasaki.
And meant that it's somebody who works with software developers to help them build software for their next platform, right? So if you worked at Apple, you'd be helping people build software for the next version of the Macintosh. If you work at Microsoft, you'll be helping people build software for the next version of Windows Vista or whatever platform we're pushing at the time.
Sure.
Brand evangelists, is more of a customer who's an evangelist on behalf of the company. And you meet these guys a lot, or people, because it's not just girls, guys. I met a woman who was a wine evangelist, actually, at a winery, and she knew more about the company than I think most of the employees do. She knew what hillside the grapes had been grown on to make the wine that we were drinking, and she knew the profit and loss of the company, and she knew the whole event schedule, and she knew all the owners, and she knew more about that company than most employees do, and therefore she was very persuasive in the talk and us into buying some wine, because she had all these stories. And I met God, who else have I met like that? Everybody's met a TiVo evangelist,
Sure.
You don't hear about TiVo from an advertisement in a magazine. I mean, most people don't, at least. But you usually hear about it from somebody you meet at a cocktail party, or your friend who bought one, and then tells you for half an hour how it's totally changed his or her life,
It's all word of mouth.
And for companies, having that kind of behavior is important, because it's a much more profitable way of marketing your company than having to buy, $3 million Super Bowl ads.
Sure.
You've seen entire companies build up around that belief. Like, Google has not done no TV advertising. Amazon's done no TV advertising. eBay does very little. Skype got to, 100 million downloads of Skype without doing any advertising, right? Why? Because people were out there telling their friends how great that product was, and the way you encourage that kind of behavior is to bring people inside the company. So, and show them, who built the product, and give them some stories about who the people are who built the product, or what kind of challenges they went around, or, in other words, educate them. And how do you do that? You do that now with blogs, because with a blog, you can search OneNote, OneNote blog on Google or MSN, and you'll find Chris Pratley, who runs the OneNote team, and you can have a conversation with him about his product. That's completely different than, 5 years ago, when you would have to go into a news group and you really didn't know who was there, who was authoritative that was there, and it was hard to have a conversation with the team.
Sure. And people generally buy from people they trust. So in a situation like this, you're developing a relationship with people who are going to be possibly selling you something. So it works to build up sales as well, because you're generating trust in your company on the internet through a blog, and then people...
Well, it doesn't just build up sales, it builds up product ideas too, right? So if you buy OneNote and... you have an idea of how to make that product better because you're using it and it's frustrating you. You know, in the old days, you would have to send an email to something like mswish@microsoft.com, or you'd have to go to a news group and leave a post in a news group, and you really didn't know that if anybody who was involved in making the product actually got that note, But now you can go to a search engine and type, OneNote blog, and you'll find Chris Pratley, and you can leave a note for him. Or if you want to tell us about Internet Explorer, there's an Internet Explorer blog, and you can leave a comment right on the comment area.
So are companies now actively using blogs to get customer feedback to help them in the product development cycle?
All over the place. I talked to an executive from Procter & Gamble, and he said they are now watching blogs for what people think about soap and, Tide and
wow.
And all the, toothpaste and all the different products that they're trying to sell.
Do people blog about toothpaste?
Not yet, but I've seen. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to learn that there is one. I just haven't looked. I mean, I the other day I found a blog written by a trucker who was driving across the United States, and every truck stop he gets to, and and he has a few extra minutes, he'll sit there and type a blog post about what he was doing.
Wow, fascinating.
I mean, you know, there's more than 20 million blogs now, and the number is doubling every 5 to 6 months.
That's right. So. Yeah. I saw that on Technorati recently. It's roughly every 5 months it doubles.
Yep.
In a world where the blogs are doubling at that kind of speed, how do you find the blog on the particular niche area that you're interested in?
Yeah, it's still pretty difficult. One way is just use Google and add the word blog to the search that you're looking for. So if you're looking for a trucker blog, you know, you put trucker blog and you'll find the guy I'm talking about. If you want to see what just got posted, Technorati or Feedster or Icerocket.com are great places to start. But what the disadvantage of those is they show you every single post that's been written with the word, you know, bowling, if you're looking for a bowling blog or something like that. And that can get a bit daunting to go through and find somebody who's interesting. The thing is, when you find somebody who's interesting, they usually have a blog role or a list of other blogs along the right side or left side of their blog. And so when you find somebody who is writing about the topic that you like, usually they have built other links to other blogs in that same, you know, vein, if they're writing about it a lot. It's not always true to be, that's not always the case, but, you know, a good 70 or 80% of the time you'll find somebody has built a little blog role where they'll link out to their favorite authors on that topic.
Sure. Just moving away from blogs or moving to the other talk that you're giving in the afternoon in the technical forum, it's about the future of social software.
Yeah.
What exactly is social software?
In simplest terms, it's software that connects people. And certainly there's a lot of examples, you know, Google's Orkut, LinkedIn, Friendster, and there's a bunch of other ones. Those were the first examples. To me, the blog is the best relationship building tool out there, and particularly when it's in combination with the search engine, because people can find you based on interest level. Because of the way the linking system works on the internet, you know, if you're looking for somebody who writes about the technology industry, it's pretty easy to find somebody just by saying, hey, technology blog or technology news blog or something like that, and you'll find a whole list of those kinds of people. And the same is true in politics. If you do a search for politics blog, you'll find a whole range of people who write about politics and are linked to a lot about that. Anyways, we're supposed to talk about the future, right?
Future social software, yeah.
It's really hard to guess the future because it's evolving so fast. You know, blogs still haven't gone totally with the mainstream. It's certainly reached a tipping point where, you know, we're seeing millions of people enter it every month, but it still hasn't gone to you know, 6 billion people. It's a long way from being as ubiquitous as a TV or as a telephone. Nice gain there. The thing that I'm noticing now is the search engines are evolving, because now that there's 20 million bloggers out there, finding a blog is pretty difficult, and you're seeing a lot of innovations in the search engines, and that's certainly going to be built out over the next year. Mapping is huge, and we haven't even started seeing the integration of maps and blogs or maps and social software. For instance, if I'm here in Mountain View, California, in the middle of Silicon Valley, and if I go to, you know, virtualearth.com or googlemaps.com, and I want to look for sushi, I can find the sushi, but I can't find any personal, you know, ratings of those sushi places. I can't, you know, and why shouldn't I be able to take my little cell phone camera, take a picture of the front of the restaurant, and then take a picture of the food I get, and take a picture of the menu, so there's three pictures there, and then write a little blog post about, you know, hey, this sushi restaurant's pretty good, it's fairly expensive, and then have you be able to see those posts over time, you know, so maybe 1,000 people rate one sushi restaurant. We have no concept of that, and that certainly is coming. The mapping thing is just too important to ignore there.
What's
beyond that, the thing that's really kept capturing my attention, I talked with last night with Douglas Engelbart, who was the inventor of the mouse, right?
Right.
He invented the mouse 40 years ago, which is just sort of amazing that you know, it took 25 years for a decently popular computer to use a mouse after he invented it. And he and I and a group of people at the dinner were talking about, you know, how bad the computer is at knowing what I have linked to or what I've talked about or what I've clicked on. You know, and certainly your desktop computer could learn a lot from your behaviors, your what we call attention data. You know, what are you paying attention to? And if you had a piece of software that was paying attention to that, then it could call out to search services or web services and bring you all sorts of interesting information that you would have to manually search on today. As an example, I've been writing a blog for 5 years now. I have no idea how many times I've linked to Dave Weiner, you know, or how many times I've talked about sushi restaurants, or how many times I've talked about, you know, Linux. I have no idea. And the search engine technology today is very rudimentary in terms of giving me any of that data back about what my behavior has been, even on the public internet, where I've explicitly said I want people to know about my thoughts on this stuff. I have no good data on that, and certainly that's being built out by entrepreneurs here in Silicon Valley. You know, that there's systems that can go through and look at your blog behavior and bring back interesting data about that blog behavior.
Wow.
And that's just some of the stuff I'm thinking about.
Sure, yeah, sure. RSS is getting a lot of press recently as well. How do you see that changing the landscape of business?
RSS?
Yeah.
That's the way people are going to have relationships with products, with people, with teams, with companies, with services, with all sorts of stuff. You know, even your Xbox, right? If you play Halo 2 now, your friends can subscribe to your RSS feed for your game playing and can see when you're getting better and better, you know, and they can watch your stats and see it compared to everybody else.
Given my level
RSS
of efficiency.
RSS is, by the way, we should step back and explain what RSS, because a lot of people still don't know what RSS is. RSS stands for Really Simple Syndication. And it's a little file or a feed that you can subscribe to using a news aggregator. And why do you care about, why would anybody do that? You know, what, isn't a web browser good enough? Well, it turns out it's not. I'm able to read 1,400 feeds a night right now because
you don't sleep.
Because of my RSS aggregator. And it's far more productive to read content or news or information in an aggregator than it is to read it on a web browser. And there's some very simple reasons why. Let's say we're competing with each other for being the best news site on a topic, on bowling, let's say. And let's say we had 100 bowling sites that we were watching every night for, you know, to make sure we kept up on the best bowling minds in the business, right? If you're using a web browser, you have to visit each of those 100 sites. If I'm using an RSS news aggregator, I only have to visit the sites that have actually published something since the last time I've been there. So if we go every 24 hours and read those sites, I've learned that only 20 to 40% of the sites actually publish something in any one day period. So I'm only actually reading 20 to 40 sites. You're having to read 100 sites. And so I'm far more, right out of the box, I'm far more productive than you are. And then it gets worse from there because if you're reading 100 sites, you actually have to visit the site. You have to wait for it to load in the browser, which takes, you know, 4 to 10 seconds. You have to then look at the page and say, is there anything new on this page? That takes your mind, you know, 5 or 10 seconds. And as the number of sites goes up, you get more and more confused. I only have to read the actual items that got published. I don't have to look at the color, you know, page around the item. I don't have to read the item that was there 2 days ago. It's 10 to 30 times more productive to read an RSS feed than it is to read a web page. So, and it comes to you. You don't have to remember the URL and go out to it. You don't have to start up anything. It just is there. It also works offline if you have the right kind of news aggregator. So if you're on a plane for a while, you have a whole bunch of content that's been collected for you and you can read offline. It's just a new way of experiencing the internet, and it's becoming more and more popular. The front page of the BBC, for instance, has RSS news feeds right there, and you can subscribe to the BBC news feeds. And there's millions of news feeds now.
And
I talked to Rick Clow, who started FeedBurner this morning, and he said the number of feeds in his system are doubling every 60 days. So you can see the growth is quite explosive.
Wow.
In the RSS world.
Wow. And it's not just news sites and blogs. More recently, we're seeing a lot of search engines building RSS feeds into their results.
Oh, everything is going to have RSS feeds. I would not be surprised to come back in 10 years and see RSS on everything in Windows, you know, because if you have an error log, that should be an RSS feed that you can subscribe to and you can read that log from anywhere in the world. Why do I have to go to it to check the feeds? Everything should come to my centralized RSS aggregator, you know, on my machine, put where I want it to be. And that might be on a phone. You know, my phone has a new RSS aggregator, which is quite nice.
So you see people moving away from browsers and more towards newsreaders?
Not... The usage model is moving away from it, yes. But browsers are going to be very, very important for a long time. There's two kinds of sites. There's the kind of site that you just want to visit once and watch a video on it. Or, your friend says, hey, check out my friend's site, and you visit, and it's not interesting to you. You still need a browser to visit that, to have that kind of usage model. But once you say, man, I love this thing, you know, I love this product, or I love this person, or I love this company, or I love this team, you know, or I love this service, now I want to subscribe to it. And, that's where RSS kicks in. And then once you subscribe to it, you don't visit again in the web browser. You visited it with your RSS aggregator.
Right, great.
So it's a new relationship, you know. The internet started in the mid-90s, well, the web started in the mid-90s, with a browse metaphor where you go to a page like the one that Yahoo started and you click around a little bit, you know, and you find, oh, there's some cool new sites today, you know, and you click around. And when there was only 1,000 or 100,000 or 1,000,000 sites, it was fairly easy to live with that model. When it got over a certain number of sites that you were interested in, then you needed search engines. So, you saw the Alta Vistas and the Googles come along. And now you're in a new world where you want to have a relationship with items on the web, and that's the subscribe era.
Right.
And that's just going to get deeper. I'm going to show a tool called OPML, which Dave Weiner was largely seen as the inventor or at least the popularizer of RSS, and he's working on something called OPML, which takes RSS and makes it far more useful.
Kicks it into high gear. We've talked about the value of blogs, but something we haven't touched on so far is the benefits of, say, podcasts or videocasts to businesses.
Yep.
How did that go?
Well, at my shop, I do a video blog where I take a low-cost camcorder around Microsoft, walk into people's offices, and say, "Hey, who are you, and what do you do here?" And that is a medium that's sort of tangential to a blog. It's sort of connected to blogging, but it's a different way of communicating. And I find that that's been very popular because there's some things that just, you know, I can tell you how Halo 2 works in text all day long, but you'll never get the idea of really what it is until I show you a video. And same thing with podcasting, right? We're having a very high bandwidth interactive conversation right now through voice.
Yeah.
That would be pretty hard to have over text. I mean, we could do it over text, but you wouldn't be able to hear the intonation in my voice. You wouldn't be able to hear if I'm passionate about something or sort of, you know, and also you don't really know if it's real, if it's done by the person who says it is.
Sure. Yeah.
Text can be done by a committee, right? You know? Yeah. And audio adds a new dimension to the realism of the relationship that people are building with each other. It's just a different way to communicate. I mean, there's reasons that people use phones, and there's reasons that they use email, and they're different. The other thing is there's a new distribution mechanism, and it's from Apple Computer, right? It's the iPod, and there's millions of iPods out there, and there's other devices we make. I'm talking to on a cell phone that has 500 megs of RAM in it. And so now that there's a new distribution mechanism that people want to listen to things, podcasting is real interesting because they can subscribe again to an RSS feed and have all the music or all the audio that's associated with that feed shoved onto your iPod so that, you know, when you get to go on your run in the morning or you're you want to listen to something different, you just turn on your iPod and listen to it. And that is very powerful as well, because it's reaching people in a way that blogs just can't. You know, I can't read blogs when I'm out running, but I can certainly listen to, you know, Don and Drew or Adam Curry or Dave Weiner on my iPod or on my portable media computer. You know, or like even my cell phone, I can listen to podcasts, which I just couldn't do, you know, if all I had was text.
And how do you find good podcasts or videocasts? I mean, they don't have the same search capabilities as, say, a text blog.
No, so they're harder to search for, but I think that'll be taken care of, you know, it's within the next year or two. I think you're going to see speech-to-text get good enough that people will stick their videos through an engine and come out with a text file that's searchable. Where were we going? It's interesting, though. You know, you might think that they're not searchable, but that's not true. If you search on the word Sparkle, for instance, on Google, one of my videos is in the number one position. If you search for Bill Gates, I think I'm at number 14 right now. And the reason is because people will link to content that they find interesting.
Uh-huh.
And it's the link that gets you in Google and MSN and Yahoo.
Sure.
It's not necessarily the content itself. And when you figure that out, then you realize how the world has changed and why some sites, you know, some podcasts are getting 500,000 users already after only doing it for a year, you know. It's the word-of-mouth network has become more efficient, and the search engines pick up on word-of-mouth more than they pick up on just the content itself.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so Sparkle, for instance, is a new tool from Microsoft, and a lot of people linked to the video I did. If you search for Office 12, for instance, I think I'm the number one or three link for a video I did. I'm getting linked, my videos are getting linked to 20 times more often than our press releases are. So, you know, there's a whole machinery here that was paid to build, you know, beautiful websites and press releases, but they're not getting linked to as much as my videos that take an hour to do.
Must be some people
that really
who are not very happy.
That something has changed in the world, and the world has, and there's something here to pay attention to.
Wow. Robert, I asked I put a post up on my own site a couple of days ago when I knew that this interview was coming up, and I asked readers of my site if they had any questions they'd like me to ask you. Do you mind taking a few questions from some of my readers?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. One of them, Frank Pendergast. Frank, basically he said, his question was, what do you do? Now, he wasn't asking that in a facetious way. I think what he wants to know is, what's your function in Microsoft? What's your job spec? If you had a job description, what would it say?
I think if you talk to my boss, he would say, I wish I could figure out what I'm saying. My day job is to do the video blog, the Channel 9 video blog. And so I go around Microsoft and interview one or two people a day and tape them and edit that and put it up for people. But my night job has always been the blog, and the blog has built the relationships that made the day job possible, for a whole lot of reasons. But what I do at night, the blog has gotten me so many relationships now with so many people that I'm almost like an ambassador or a face or an ambassador to Microsoft, so people invite me to speak and stuff like that. And internally, I'm a pollinator because I'm one of the few people who gets to go around and see, you know, a good cross-section of the groups here, and I get to see patterns that maybe other people don't get to see, and I get to put together things. So, for instance, today I was visiting with a customer who was showing me their new products and services that they're coming out with, and I'm connecting them back into the company because I know the head of the Internet Explorer team, and I know the head of the, I know Ray Ozzie, I know executives, I know the guy who does mergers and acquisitions, so I'm getting him to look at it, and so I'm a pollinator that is putting together interesting relationships inside the company, and that's not something that's written in my review goals. it's just something that's growing out of this new world where you're a relationship manager almost, because by writing a blog every day, people see who you are and want to talk to you and want to share their information with you. It's a very interesting new job that I have.
No doubt.
I didn't foresee doing this 5 years ago when I started blogging,
Of course, no. You'd have to have incredible foresight to have seen something like that. I mean, I think the example that comes to my mind of someone with incredible foresight would be Bill Gates back in 78 saying he wanted to put Microsoft software on desktop machine on everyone in the world's house.
Yep. He didn't he didn't even get it. if you talk to him, he will tell you he didn't get it either. A lot of this is accidental, and he'll admit that. For instance, he started Microsoft as a tools business. His love was BASIC compilers. And he sent away IBM twice when they came looking for an operating system. And twice they came back and said, "We need something from you. The guys you're sending us to aren't doing the job,"
Amazing.
And that's how sometimes business is just very accidental, and blogging was accidental. I didn't think it was important enough to do a conference session on it, right? That's how I got into blogging. I was helping run the CNetBuilder.com live conference in 98 and 99. And you know, I kept asking my speakers, what should we cover? And two of them, Dory Smith and Dave Weiner, told me, hey, why don't you do something on blogging? It seems to be pretty interesting. And I did some homework, and I said, there's only 200 people in the world who are doing blogs. You know, what, how can I justify putting that on stage, you know? And so I didn't even think it was important enough. And, you know, I thought it was important enough to do it, but not to put it on stage. You know, and it just the thing is, sometimes you'll hit a technology or a movement or, you know, an idea that keeps doubling every 5 months, and you know, 200 became 400, then 400 became 800, and 800 became 1600, and now the numbers are just staggering.
Astronomical,
you know?
Yeah.
So. And I'm sure, you know, I've talked to Steve Wozniak and Bill Gates, and they didn't know what they were, so, you know, they just wanted computers for themselves, and, you know, yeah, Bill would love to tell you that he saw a huge business, you know, but he I don't think he did. Yeah, I just talked to the two guys who started Google, and they claimed they saw a large business, but, they had entered a place that there already was a sizable business, you know,
sure.
So.
It was, the space was there, yeah.
Yeah.
Another one of my readers, a guy called Ed Byrne, has a question. He says, with so many bloggers now and an ever more exclusive blogging A-list, do you think that new bloggers will find it hard to get an audience with so much of a demand on people's attention already?
No. It took me 10 days to get to 3,000 readers, and it was off of one link a day, one site. My wife in the first month had 40,000 visitors. She had a guy who linked to her who, you know, sent her a lot of readers, but it's now going on its own, and people are linking to her for her own regard. My son got discovered not by me, but by people who were watching search engines for my name.
All right.
And, you know, within an hour, a few hours of his post, people were linking to him. You know, and that's why I tell PR people now, if you better pay attention to the guy who only has 5 readers, you know, because you don't have 5 readers for more than an hour, you know, only 5 readers. Because of the search engines, I can watch Feedster for anybody who's in the world who says Microsoft on their blog. You know, whether you're, you know, have a million readers or have 2 readers, you show up in that search. And so if I'm a journalist and I'm writing about Microsoft, now I can watch what everybody says. I don't have to just watch what, you know, the PR team says or the famous journalists or the famous bloggers say. Everybody gets noticed. And, yeah, you have to be good. You have to be interesting. It is more crowded. So if you're trying to become known as a tech blogger, it takes a little bit more skill than maybe I had or have. But, you know, look at Michael Arrington over at TechCrunch. You know,
sure.
6 months ago, I didn't know about that site.
Yeah.
And now today, 6 months later, it's like the number one, you know, site that I go to. You know, Memorandum didn't exist, 2 months ago, and today I visit that site 15 times a day, and that certainly exposes a lot of new blogs that I've never heard of before. So, you know, if you're interested in traffic, you know, we can talk about ways to get traffic, but to me it's more about getting, you know, a few people who really care about what you care about to read you, and you should be reading them and building a little club. You build a little club like that, and all of a sudden, boom, other people might find it interesting, you know.
Yeah, link to other people's articles.
I sort of think it's the wrong reason to blog, you know, to just go and get traffic. Every time I try to blog to get traffic, it's shallow, you know. It's not the right reason to blog. The right reason to blog is because you have something interesting to share, you know. And it might only be interesting to your kid, right? You know, if you have pictures of yourself and your family, put them up. You know, and maybe only your kid's going to watch them or look at them. But you never know.
not my pictures, no. No one wants to see pictures of me. Another guy called Justin Flavin, or Flavin, I'm not sure how you pronounce his surname. He wants to know, is Vista really based on BSD?
No. His
follow-up question is, can it be proven that it's not?
Yeah, because we give the source code out to a lot of the MVPs, and they could verify for you pretty quickly what it's based on. A lot of people think we don't share our source code out, but when I was an MVP, I had full access to the Windows source code. I had to sign a non-disclosure, and all that fun stuff, but I had the ability to look at it. It's pretty easy to see that, what it's built on. It's our own stuff.
It's not BSD anyway.
We have our own kernel team.
Okay.
Certainly the DOJ looks through it, so if we're copying things, they can figure that out pretty fast, too.
Sure. I have another guy called Damien Mully,
yep.
who wants to know, who can throw a chair further, you or Steve Ballmer?
I'm sorry, who
can throw a chair further, you or Steve Ballmer?
Well, Steve Ballmer, this is one of those funny things when a story like that gets reported, everybody believes it's true, but he swears he didn't throw any chairs in his life. Maybe that's his college roommate that is doing the chair throwing, Jim Cramer on Mad Money, which is a pretty funny show, but he throws a chair every night on his show. I don't know. I mean, Bomber, he's in a lot better shape than I am. He plays basketball and is a pretty big guy. So I'd say he'd probably win a contest like that.
Damien has a more serious question, though. He asks, what kind of world do you want your son's kids to grow up in, and how can you and Microsoft and other companies go about forming that world? It's kind of a deep one.
I want him to grow up in a world where he is where mastery is appreciated, where people who build things and even sport. If you're gonna do anything, do it to the utmost. And the internet lets you master a lot of things, without doing a lot of work. Today you can learn to. Here's a good example. You can learn to ride a bike on the internet.
No way.
And it's out there. Do a search for learn how to teach your kid a bike, how to ride a bike, and there's a whole bunch of content out there. To find something like that before would have required you to go down to a library. And libraries are a new invention, right? They're only a few hundred years old. And figure out how to use a card catalog and find the book. And God forbid if the book was checked out, then you couldn't learn that day, the internet has brought all that stuff to your house and to you in a whole new way. I hope that the idea that you're going to master something doesn't get lost. It's so easy to become, to do something superficially, to learn it well enough to do it, but it's really hard to master something. But other than that, I want them to always look for ways to improve the human existence, to improve himself, stay up on to enjoy learning. I don't know.
Okay. Great. We'll move on. We have another question from a hostile, and the hostile asks, what do you find compelling about working for Microsoft?
We have cool Wi-Fi at all the offices across the world. Microsoft is a very compelling company to me because it's one of the companies that's doing all sorts of different things in all sorts of different fields and often with the best people in that field. You know, I've met the guy who invented the laser printer. I've hung out with the Xbox team. I'm here in Silicon Valley where Hotmail is developed. You know, and IPTV, which is coming out next year, which is just stunning. I mean, the stuff that they're doing. And stuff that we don't get a lot of credit for, you know. But Xbox, I was at Best Buy this weekend, and I had to wait half an hour in line just to play the Xbox 360, you know. And people sometimes forget that kind of worldwide impact that a company of this size can have on a new technology or new product is quite amazing. It's a big company and it's worldwide. Doing, you know, the people here are doing just amazing things. But you know, I met one of the researchers who's working on curing AIDS with computers. You know, with some medical scientists, and you wouldn't expect, you know, Microsoft to do that kind of work either. We're building computers into cars. The Auto PC Group is doing amazing stuff with Daimler Chrysler and other companies. We have a new toy coming out next year or soon called the Playtable. That's just amazing. Here's a little demo that they did for me. I walked in, I see this table. It looks like a kid's table, and they hand me a stack of glass chips. And I look through the glass chips, and I can't see anything on the glass chips. And I put it down on the table, and a video starts playing on the glass chip. I turn the glass chip. The video follows the glass chip. I move the glass chip across the table, and the video follows the glass chip. You know, it's playing on the glass chip. I take the glass chip off the table. The video stops playing. I put it back on. The same video plays. You know, and that's all done with software. You know, I can tell you how it's done. When you see something like that, that thrills you and amazes you and is something that I don't really, you know, expect from the company that built Windows and Office, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay.
I could keep going for a few hours. I've been spending a year and a half going through, meeting people at Microsoft offices all over the world, and I've only talked to maybe 600 people out of the 60,000 employees who work here. So
you have a long way to go yet.
Yep.
Meet them all.
I think I have a job for a few decades. and that's if we stop growing, which we're not stopping at all. I mean, you know, you see, we're hiring 5,000 people this year, something like that. You know, so it's just an amazing company.
You got to go faster. Another question from Hostile again is what do you find so compelling this time about blogging? I guess we covered a lot of that.
I'll answer it real easily. I had dinner last night with Douglas Engelbart because of my blog. End of story. That's what's interesting about it. Blogging is the world's best relationship building device I've ever found, and it's gotten me in amazing places. And gotten me amazing friends and experiences, and it started very quickly. You know, I'm going to London. You know, right before I talk in Ireland, I have a geek dinner in London, which more than 100 people have signed up for. I have a geek dinner in Cork that I think, you know, I don't know how many people are going
to
come, and
40 to 50,
in Dublin, you know. And the number of people who show up to these things just because I write something on my blog is stunning to me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Hostile has one final question.
Yep.
And he says, I bet you won't go near this one. And the question is, do you agree with Microsoft's dirty tactics in the past and present of disposing of competitors like Netscape, Real Media, and the latest SCO secret society they're funding to smear the name of Linux?
I don't agree with it, and I will go toward that, and I'll tell Bill that to his face. You know, we should compete fairly and transparently and openly, and you know, put all of our chips out on the table and let the customer decide which is the best product. You know, and I think Microsoft comes comes up to that bar. A lot of people will disagree with me there, but I'm standing in line at the Best Buy this weekend, and there was 20 people waiting in line. Why? It wasn't because somebody held a gun to their head. It's because we built a product that's thrilling, you know, and that's interesting. And that's how you compete. And, you're seeing competitors who are doing interesting things. God bless them, you know.
Great, good answer. Back to a couple of questions I have just before we wrap up. Completely off topic. Is there anything in particular you're looking forward to from your trip to Ireland or Cork?
I've never been there, so I have really no concept of what I'm going to learn or the people I'm going to meet or, you know, the kinds of experiences I'm going to have. I'm just going to try to soak it in as deeply as possible, you know, and see what happens.
Have you heard of the Blarney Stone?
I have.
that's not too far from us here in Cork. The rumor is, or the story goes, that if you kiss the Blarney Stone, you'll get what's called the gift of the gab.
Do I need any more of that?
I was just going to say, do you think you need it?
I'll go kiss the stone.
Excellent. We've got to get a picture of that.
Okay.
Robert, thanks a million for doing the interview. And it's been a great talk.
Thank you.
We look forward to seeing you on the 30th in Cork.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And that's it.
It's been a pleasure being on.
Great. Thanks a million, Robert.